WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest, historian and novelist Frederick Morton, grew up in Vienna. Shortly after Morton's bar mitzvah, Hitler annexed Austria, and the Morton family fled. Now Morton lives near the Hudson, not the Danube, but several of his books are about Vienna. His novel, The Forever Street, is a fictionalized account of three generations of his family. A Nervous Splendor is a history of Vienna in 1888 and 89, 2 years Morton describes as representative of a watershed when the Western dream started to go wrong dramatically. His new book, Thunder at Twilight, is about Vienna in the 2 years before World War I, the last days of the Austrian Empire, when Freud, Hitler, Trotsky, and Stalin all lived in Vienna. Morton describes the book as an exploration of history backstage. He believes we have some false impressions about how World War I got started.
What is most amazing about the genesis of World War I is that it happened against the wishes of the top leadership of all countries concerned, with the possible exception of France. And even there, the prime minister, the chief executive officer, did everything he could to prevent it. It was the president of France who was, in terms of constitutional power, just a symbol without any actual executive power, who wanted war. But the main dynamic force that started the war were the people of Western Europe. There was this incredible jubilation in all streets, not just in Vienna, but not just in Berlin, but in France, in England, in Russia, when the war started. I quote Trotsky, who lived in Vienna at the time, when he wrote his autobiography. He wrote, and I can't remember the verbatim phrasing, but it went something like this. He said, "I cannot believe that on the Ringstrasse, the main boulevard of Vienna, where on May 1st the workers marched for peace, for bread, for a better life, that this same boulevard is now filled with the same workers cheering the Austrian emperor, saying, 'Alle Serben müssen sterben,' which meant that all Serbs must die." Then I quote a British diplomat in St. Petersburg, then the Russian capital, and he said, "It's a miracle. 2 months ago, the greatest strikes the world's have ever seen, the world has ever seen, which were happening in Russia in April and May of 1914. Everybody has gone back to work during the day, but at night they are out on the street, they are in front of the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, cheering the Tsar, saying, 'We will kill the Germans, we will kill the Austrians.'" And that same scene in St. Petersburg, in Vienna, was duplicated on the streets in Paris and in London and in Belgrade. And my main work as a writer towards the end of Thunder at Twilight was to explore what made this mass psychosis possible, how that happened.
Let me skip ahead a few years to the time when you fled Germany with your family. This was in the late 1930s, right after Austria was annexed by the Germans. Actually, before we talk about your personal story, I'm interested in if you have any personal fear about the possible reunification of Germany in the light of the wall being toppled.
Not really, because nationalism in Western Europe has been diffused. The main problem in Western Europe will be the same problem that we have here. That is, it's no longer nations against nations, it's within the nations, everybody against everybody else. Crime, drugs, those were poverty. Those are the main problems. I have gone to Germany and I have been in Austria and I have lectured there, and I do not get a sense of the sort of gritty, angry nationalism at all that was there 50 years ago. So I am not afraid of a unified Germany.
Mm-hmm. Frederick Morton is my guest, and his new book, Thunder at Twilight, is about Vienna in the years 1913 and 1914. Now, your grandfather founded a factory in, I believe it was 1888?
Right.
And the factory made custom jewelry?
Right.
I think there were several times in the history of your family's factory when it had to crank out things for the empire or for the government and finally for Hitler.
Right. He wrote a novel called The Forever Street, which deals with that. In a peculiar way, my grandfather's factory and then my father's factory was quite literally emblematic. That is, they not only manufactured custom jewelry, but they also manufactured the badges for whatever political structure was prevalent. During the empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they manufactured medals and decorations that were bestowed by the emperor, military medals during the war, the equivalent, let's say, of the Purple Heart, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Those Austrian equivalents were manufactured by my grandfather's factory. Then after the war, they manufactured the political badges of the Socialist Party, never of the Nazi Party because they were Jewish, of course, but of the other parties. Then when my father's factory was taken over by the Nazis, that same factory manufactured Nazi medals, also Wehrmacht medals. And when my father was once more given back the factory, what we inherited was not only sort of the wreck of the factory because it was damaged during the war, but also a complete collection of Nazi emblems of badges, of which I have at home here on the Upper West Side in New York, a collection of such badges. Now, the feeling, if this apartment should ever be raided, I might be the one Jew ever arrested for Nazi activities. Yes.
In the novel that you were just referring to, The Forever Street, there's an imperative life and death order that the government, the Austrian government, issues to the boy's father's factory to create party badges. Did your father ever get one of these imperative life and death orders?
Well, he himself got a death order in the sense that he was arrested and sent to Dachau, Kristallnacht, and after that he was no longer in charge of the factory. But his successor was ordered, but also, since he was himself a Nazi, didn't have to be ordered to manufacture those medals. And he made a good deal of money on them, too.
Mm-hmm. What was your earliest sensing of the Nazis and of a probable Nazi invasion?
Well, there were a lot of inklings along the way, and I remember being, I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old, and I'm walking with my parents along a street in Vienna, and all of a sudden I hear march music and colorful-looking flags, and I began to run towards, it was a spectacle when my father suddenly yanked me back and said, "Don't go there. Those are the enemies. They might beat us up." It was a Nazi parade. And then he had to explain to me what the Nazis really were. And that was my first intimation of what might happen. And, of course, as I became a little older and began to read the newspapers, there was this cloud on the horizon. Austria was this little sliver on the map of Europe, and the huge hulk of Germany pressed against the borders of that little sliver. And we knew that sooner or later that little sliver would be swallowed up by the hulk. And, of course, you saw Nazi emblem, swastikas painted on the walls, and remarks behind our backs. We lived in a non-Jewish district. Many of the people who, by the way, lived in awful poverty at the time, because the depression in Austria was worse than the American depression, and the Nazis were one of the, more or less, the chief messianic hope of many of these people. So the pressure was there all along.
Were your parents urged to flee? Did they think of fleeing?
Well, when we came home late on the late afternoon of March 11th, 1938, the Austrian Chancellor was supposed to hold a speech urging people to vote for the plebiscite, or to vote in the plebiscite for him and against an Anschluss. And he did hold a speech, but it was not the speech he was supposed to hold. It was a speech of surrender. He said he had gotten an ultimatum, and in order to avoid bloodshed, he was resigning and that the Nazi government was taking over. And at that point, we knew we had to decide. Vienna is only an hour and a half from the Czech border. And my parents couldn't make the decision. They knew it was coming, but they were so rooted in Austria, and they had so many friends, including non-Jewish ones, they could not make that decision fast enough. The next day they wanted to go, but it was too late. The borders were closed.
Well, you were just telling us that your parents decided to flee right after the Nazis invaded, but it was too late. What are your memories of the invasion?
Well, the first concrete evidence of the Germans coming in was a sound from the sky. It was an overcast day. This, I'm talking about March 12, 1938. And above those clouds, there was a tremendous drone, and then from the clouds fell tens of thousands of leaflets, and above us, the drone was the German Luftwaffe, who were already over Vienna, and the leaflets they dropped, of course, said Austrian Germans, Deutsche Österreicher, which means Austrian Germans, the day of your liberation has come, your misery is over, the greatness of the Reich will be yours, etc., etc. And then there was, in the course of the day, the stormtroopers that came out of the woodwork and paraded down the street, and there was a tremendous sense of jubilation, from which, of course, the Jews were shut out completely. We were just trembling, really, and waiting for whatever was to befall us. But the people of Vienna at that point really believed that the day of the Messiah had come. And Hitler was very clever in exploiting the tremendous sense of not only economic deprivation, which the Austrians had at that time, but also a lack of identity. I mean, in Thunder or Twilight, I deal about the final days of the empire, and Austrians really saw themselves not so much during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they saw themselves not so much as Austrians, as citizens of a great Habsburg realm. And when that realm fell apart, after thunder and lightning exploded that twilight, what was left in the gray of day was something they couldn't identify with. The little state of Austria was in a limbo, and Hitler very cleverly replaced the Habsburg Empire with the Third Reich. And the tremendous sense of pageantry that he had, and which incidentally in Thunder at Twilight I show how he learned pageantry from the Habsburg Empire. The great May Day March of the Socialists itself was an offshoot of Habsburg pageantry. The great Catholic processions at Corpus Christi, the great society parades in the Praterstrasse, those were all parts of the pomp and circumstance that gave first the Catholic Church and then the Catholic Church and the Habsburg Empire a theatrical grandeur in which the people could participate. But after the First World War, after, as I said, thunder and had sundered and fragmented the glorious sunset twilight of the Habsburg Empire, all that was gone. And Hitler, with the Anschluss, reinstated that. And those great parades of the Nazis, the party congresses, the massed flags of the SS and the stormtroopers, all that was a recreation of what Hitler had learned in the streets of Vienna in 1913-14. That's why he said in Mein Kampf that my political education was taking place and completed in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. After the Anschluss, the annexation by Germany of Austria, did you have relatives who were taken to the concentration camps?
Sure. As I said, my father was arrested. He was lucky. He got out again in February 1940. He's alive today with my mother. But two of my grandmothers, both my grandmothers, I should say, were not only arrested, but probably gassed.
So your father was in a camp when you fled the country?
No. My father came out, as I said, in February 1940, and in July of 1940, we left for England and stayed there until January 1941, and then came to this country.
You've said that your new book, Thunder at Twilight, is in a way an attempt to figure out why there was the mass psychosis that led to World War One. You're interested in trying to find out why there are periods in which angry nationalism overcomes people. I know this is a hard question to boil down into a simple answer, but nevertheless, let me ask you to share with us some of the conclusions you've come to.
Well, the conclusions I've come to, I wrote a book called Crosstown Sabbath, which deals with just the psychological dynamics that led to both the psychosis of World War I jubilation in the streets and to the problem we live with today. They all have to do with alienation, with the fact that we have, in industrializing ourselves, uprooted ourselves, and that there are tens of thousands of small communities all over the world, especially the industrialized world, which have disappeared, and that people need, man being a political animal in the sense of polis, of the community, need some sort of equivalent. And to regain the sense of community, to regain the village that has been lost, the nation has been substituted for by the alienated masses. And this sense of finding yourself with your brethren once more after having lost the sense of brotherhood, that was the psychological dynamic for that jubilation. But to find a brother, you need an enemy. And finally, the kind of enemy had been found that allowed people to be brothers again. And that was, I think, one of the main driving forces that made people run out into the street and jubilate when they heard that when the war was declared. And people knew it was going to be a world war because the major powers were serving ultimatums at each other.
Do you feel that there's this type of dangerous nationalism happening now any place in the world?
Among the less developed countries, yes. Among the developed industrialized nations, we have given up on any kind of really community-oriented remedies for our alienation. We have found, we nowadays think, that the way to find our personal salvation is purely through ourselves. We, each one of us, has to become a star. We don't need the community anymore. The community, which was an important factor in the lives of the less developed members of nations, is now no longer a really alive factor in our lives today. We are much too me-oriented to think of community which is both good and bad. It is bad in the sense, of course, and fundamentally and irremediably bad, I think, because we are still a political animal. But it is only good in the sense that nationalism, which is still a community-oriented goal, is really no longer viable. And you will see that when Germany should be united, the entire issue of Alsace-Lorraine, over which wars were fought so many times, Alsace-Lorraine being the contested territory between Germany and France, all that has disappeared. When I go to Germany or Austria today and I read German papers or I read French papers, that is an issue that just doesn't exist anymore. But the issue of fulfilling yourself alone as an individual, becoming a millionaire, becoming a star, shooting up and achieving a high in that way, being while you have that high, you are the star, that is the thing, that is the new remedy, and that is our new and growing and I think a very tough problem.
So you think we've gone from one extreme to another?
Yes, in that sense, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you don't like either extreme?
No.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Nice to be here.